Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public service, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Bruno Barron, Marty Garrity, Dave Lundy, and John McCarron. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, we're going to talk about this past historic week where the re-inauguration of President Barack Obama. We'll talk about the inaugural speech. Hillary Clinton testified before Congress. We're going to talk a little bit about that, sort of the beginning of the rebranding of the Republican Party we'll talk about. And in the second hour, we're going to be talking about school choice and public education in America and how we might be able to improve it. And again, we begin by talking about the inaugural speech of President Obama. And I think one thing that he said, we cannot mistake absolutism for principle or substitute spectacle for politics or treat name-calling as reasonable debate. And he said that this that Americans are at a – that they're made for this particular moment, suggesting that he, too, is made for this moment. And he said that the nation must seize it together. Dave Lundy, you are the closest thing to a card-carrying Democrat at the table this evening. Your reaction to the speech and whether or not you think there are people out there that want to seize this moment with Barack Obama.
Well, I was actually struck by how just in-your-face progressive the speech was. While I am as close to a card-carrying Democrat as you may find at the table, I tend to be a fairly moderate, pragmatic Democrat. And I was struck by how brilliantly he articulated what the progressive vision was. You know, he did something that I've seen him do going all the way back to the Iowa caucus, to the Jefferson-Jackson dinner with Hillary Clinton. He laid out, he took digs at his opponents, but did it in such an artful, masterful way. It was like one of those dog whistle moments you love to talk about. If you heard it, you know, you really were paying attention. But I thought it was fantastic.
Marty Garrity is the closest thing to a card-carrying conservative Republican, although there's someone that may be vying for that title this evening. Your reaction to the speech?
Well, I was far less impressed by its artfulness and more struck by the in-your-face nature of it. I thought it was a challenge essentially saying, you folks that didn't vote for me, the hell with you. We're going to shove this down your throat. And he clearly intends to do that. He had already shoved down the throat of Boehner and McConnell his tax increases, and that we're looking forward, I think, to 2 years of
and
of,
you did not and you did and you did not watch it. You
I watched it.
You
yeah.
watched you watched a portion of it. Mm-hmm. Okay, John McCarron, you're the closest thing to a card-carrying journalist we have here, adjunct professor at DePaul University, 30 plus years with the Chicago Tribune. Your reaction to the speech?
I thought it was a good speech. It was very different than the last time around. His first inaugural speech because it was more combative, I think. And I think he would have looked silly if he had come out and given another kumbaya, we can all bury our differences and we can all, because that's, I mean, if the last 2 years have proven anything, it's that the Republicans aren't going to play ball. You know, John Boehner and Mitch McConnell are just not out to compromise on stuff. So he's got to try something else.
Bruno Barron is our other card-carrying conservative.
Yes, I would. And incidentally, for the audience and everybody out there, I did not get a chance to. I've read portions of the speech. I've seen some commentary on it. I didn't see it, and I haven't read it. I've seen portions of it. My view is that the in-your-face nature says it all. I mean, this is a guy who won the election with 52-point-something% of the vote. Mitt Romney got 47-point-something. The country's clearly divided. The House stayed in the hands of the Republicans. Basically, the election wasn't a vote for Barack Obama as much as it was a vote for the status quo. That's what they got. The Senate stayed in the Democrats' hands. The House stayed in the Republicans' hands.
But there was a clear vote. I mean, mm-hmm. One of the great things about the election, there was a clear choice for the nation to make. as to who they wanted to be the leader of their country.
Yes.
And they clearly chose, it wasn't really that close at the end, they clearly chose Barack Obama. And I guess my question to everyone, I'll start with the Democrats, okay, he won the election. Why shouldn't this be his, why shouldn't he throw something out to those that supported him, that put him there? I mean, is it any different than what Ronald Reagan did in his inaugural speeches? I mean, to the victor goes the spoils, Dave.
You know, Bruce, you hit the nail on the head. I remember the early 1980s, Ronald Reagan's first term. I found it so frustrating that Democrats would just roll over for all of these Reagan initiatives, and yet it was pointed out over and over, and I was pretty young in those days. It was pointed out he won the election.
Yeah.
He won the election. That seems to be
really
a concept.
Big, bigger than Barack Obama.
Oh, clearly.
But, he won it.
But in the 80 election,
yeah.
it was big,
close,
but not,
yeah,
not
close,
crazy.
Right.
I think it was 8 million votes. Barack won by 5 million votes. But I think that the more often you hear Republicans articulate what Bruno just articulated very nicely here, the more you realize they don't get it yet. They didn't just lose the presidency. They didn't just lose seats in the Senate in a year that they were expected to take over the Senate. They lost in places like North Dakota, my favorite candidate, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota. They lost a majority of the votes for the U.S. Congress, but for gerrymandering, they wouldn't have the House. And they, all of the efforts that they tried to play out in things like the voter ID, they backfired. Just like what they started to do this week with changing the electoral college system in these states around the country. And all of a sudden you're hearing it's just not going to happen. Stop trying to change the rules. Start competing for the American people straight up.
Bruno.
First of all, it's I don't necessarily think it's fair to say that Republicans don't get it. We're just trying to be a little bit more realistic than all of the, you know, oh, it was a masterful speech and all this other kind of stuff. Clearly the United States of America seems to be moving in a more progressive or what I might call a European style direction where people are saying, well, we want more, we deserve more, we should get more from the government. And that is a debate that has to be had, and it's a debate that, quite frankly, the Republicans didn't do a very good job articulating
but
anything
he didn't
against.
He didn't really say that in the speech. Did you hear him say that in the speech, Marty?
Oh, sure.
Okay, when I watched the speech and when I read the speech, I mean, he was talking about American ideals, American principles, and he was reminding people in his base that they, too, are coming along, and they're along for the ride. They're along for the promise of America that everyone has been basically offered every 4 years by every president of all parties. He singled a few people out.
The race boiled down to the Republicans saying, yeah, we've got to look at entitlements. We've got to take a look at how we award Social Security checks and Medicare checks and things like that to our citizens.
He said those people are not takers.
What he said was, we don't have to make a choice between taking care of those people who have already given money, who have already started to receive their funds. Or
the greatest
generation. Educating our kids. We can just spend away. We don't have to worry about money.
Did he say that? I brought my copy. Did he say that, Marty? Let me see there.
Not so much.
Spend away.
By the way, while you're looking up the specific, I don't believe he said spend away either. But
nor did he imply spend
away. That's what Marty heard.
Exactly. What he did say, he said,
One second. We got a break. You're going to do it on the other side. 1-800-723-8029. Wherever you're listening tonight, I'm sure you have a comment on the president's inaugural speech. If you saw it, if you read it, give us a call. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago. From Tyler, Texas to Sacramento, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Nice to have you with us this evening. John McCarron, you've got a copy of the speech right in front of you. You're going to clarify it.
My good friend Marty said the president wanted to spend away, but I don't find that in the speech. What he did say is, we the people still believe that every citizen deserves a basic measure of security and dignity, but we must make the hard choices to reduce the cost of health care and the size of our deficit. So people say he didn't deal with the deficit. I mean, he did deal
with
it.
Read the next sentence, John.
My problem with the speech, Bruce, was that it was just a speech. And you know, 2 days later, the Democrats, in effect, threw in the towel in the Senate, where they had a chance to revise the rules to get around this the obstructionism of the filibuster. They kind of sold out for just a minor technical thing that's going to make it just a little bit harder to tie up the Senate. And to me, that was really a bad signal if you're a progressive Democrat that, you know, here was a chance to actually do something, not speak about it, but actually do something, and they threw in the towel.
John, you forgot to finish the sentence. But we reject the belief that America must choose between caring for the generation that built this country and investing in the generation that will build its future. We can care for them. We can invest in them. Of course, remember, the Democrats—
Can you do both?
I think the answer is no.
The answer has to be no.
The answer and there isn't enough tax dollars in the world to fund everything that's been promised in the structure that it's been promised. And this is what I think is fascinating because,
So who do we throw overboard?
You don't have to throw anybody overboard. Well, you can just restructure the system. Now, if someone stands up and says, here's a way to restructure it, and then someone else runs an ad showing Paul Ryan throwing somebody off a cliff, I think we're beyond having a rational discussion. But the fact is that Obama, and this was in an article I read, you know, I can't Google everything instantaneously here, but this was something that shocked Boehner, whatever his flaws in negotiating all this stuff have been. It shocked Boehner that he actually heard the president say twice in the room with all of these negotiations that America doesn't have a spending problem. I would submit to a conservative Democrat, progressive Democrat, conservative Republican, America sure as hell has a spending problem. And if you can't even get that far, then I think it's fair to say that we have a president that absolutely refuses to negotiate.
Yeah, but what the president was referring to was not whether we have to make hard choices, was not whether we were willing to cut spending. He has repeatedly offered grand bargains. They have repeatedly been rejected. What the president was referring to is that as a fact, as a fundamental fact, we are at our lowest level of federal taxation since 1948. We are living with a 2010 era entitlement system, including Medicare and an aging population, and a 1950s era tax system. We are, if you just look at the number as a percentage of GDP, we are dramatically undertaxed compared to what we are trying to spend.
The question I have is, why does he have to compromise now? He's been reelected. He doesn't have to go to the post again. He's immensely popular. Over 72% of the American people like him personally. Even Republicans who don't like his policies, they like him personally. Demographically, the Republican Party seems to be, you know, on the edge of a cliff here. Why does he have to give in to them?
Because he doesn't have the votes. He's in a minority situation in the House.
Can he win by trying?
60 votes to win in the Senate.
Can he win by trying, though?
No.
The best thing to do in politics is to pick a fight and win the fight. It seems to be that the second best thing in politics is to stand up for what you believe in. You may lose, but maybe you're picking up a lot of support along the way.
Yeah, well,
is that good enough?
I think what he's probably going to try to do is back on the hustings, which is unfortunate, I think, to basically stay in a campaign mode, keep his, you know, his huge listserv, his mailing list, churning away, writing letters to their congressmen and their senators, maybe aiming toward the 2014 congressionals, hoping maybe they can improve a lot there. I don't think it's going
to
work.
To your point, and I think this is important, first of all, it's an open question as to whether the grand bargain that was offered was a real grand bargain. But I will say this. If Barack Obama was serious about putting Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security issues on the table, and the Republicans were to reject it, the Republicans would be absolutely stupid to reject it. My understanding was, whether Barack Obama was serious or not, the trial balloon of any of that was completely shot down by Harry Reid in the Senate, basically throwing a conniption fit and saying, you can't even talk about that anymore. Here's the thing, and I said this to every Democrat a few weeks ago when we were walking out of this show. If Barack Obama pulled off a grand bargain and the Republicans were smart enough to take it, something that really did have dollar-for-dollar tax increases with dollar-for-dollar spending cuts, not only would it be good for the country, I think it would be good for the president, it would be good for both parties.
Dave, I want to come back to something you said. You said that even though you described yourself as a moderate Democrat, you said he was playing his left card or his liberal card. What in that speech, to your ears, were the liberal points that he ticked off?
Oh, gosh. You know, it was more that he went again and again and again talking about – now, mind you, this might fit into more of a philosophical point, but he went over and over talking about our responsibility as a society to care for others. He talked about the need to protect others. He specifically mentioned Stonewall, which, of course, you know, so that was a shout out
to the gay community. And Selma.
But Selma's okay. Hispanic. You can say that in this is the first time you had said anything about gays or the word gay. So that clearly
said our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. And he put that in context with the law, that this is a time for all the boats to rise up. Everybody to feel like they're in the
But 20 years ago, that cost, I mean, not even 20 years ago, 8 years ago, that cost John Kerry Ohio.
Is that one of the points that stuck in your craw?
Absolutely. He's looking at the country and saying, okay, 41 of the 50 states have not chosen this route, but we're going to shove it down your throats, folks. That's
in what way? How are they going to shove it down the throat? I mean,
well,
the Supreme Court is going to decide it. Well, gays are serving in the military.
If he's bringing it up, he intends to do something about it.
Justice Department is going to, you know, past justice departments, and including Bill Clinton, who passed the Defense of Marriage Act, would have defended the Defense of Marriage Act. Now the Justice Department is going to argue against the Defense of Marriage Act, which may or may not be dispositive.
But if 90%+ of the gays and lesbians in America voted for Barack Obama, why would he not try to do something to make their lives better?
It's his choice.
Sure.
But
that's the point. He is choosing. He is saying to those people who didn't vote for him, I'm not listening to you. I'm listening to them.
Well, I would say that's a pretty good politician.
Take care of your base, always.
I have to tell you, I object to the concept of he's going to shove it down our throat. When I talk about this as a progressive speech, what I'm talking about is he laid out principles. He laid out principles, he laid out values, and one of those is about equality and protecting the gay community. The fact is that this country is dramatically changing in gay issues at a remarkable rate that is way faster than we ever changed on issues of race. And you're looking at the next generation coming up are very open to gay rights. I mean, I just think the president was giving a statement that is consistent with where we are moving as a country.
He even threw climate change on the heap of things that he wants to deal with.
Which that one I'll believe when I see it.
That's a good red meat issue on a speech, no matter what, especially if you're a Democrat giving a speech like that. Look,
we have this speech. Okay, now we're going to have the State of the Union speech. And then the budget's going to come out. So, I mean, each of these speeches is meant for a different audience, for a different purpose. I mean, are we going to see more meat on the bones? John, that's generally what you get the State of the Union can still be somewhat fluffy.
We're going to find out what can be done ministerially and what requires legislative approval. And anything in the former category probably will be tried, especially when it comes to climate change. I think the EPA is going to be more aggressive, perhaps no more new coal plants and whatnot.
But he's got a basic problem.
It's going to end up in the courts, isn't it?
He's got a basic problem in that a key phenomenon that could reduce the value of green energy and recyclable stuff and everything is natural gas, because natural gas isn't very polluting, and if it becomes efficient and inexpensive, then all of this green energy stuff that he's been loaning our federal funds for will go down the tubes, and all of his friends in the green energy movement will lose out.
I work in the green energy space. I also work in energy. I also work in natural gas. There natural gas prices are low because of fracking. That is true, but that does not. And by the way, Keystone has nothing to do with this. Keystone isn't even a drop in the bucket. Natural gas prices have had a meaningful impact on keeping costs under control in this country. But natural gas emits half the greenhouse gases that coal does. So it is a progressive thing to move from coal to natural gas, which has been happening because of the EPA and because of the market. But that doesn't take away the fact that you want an energy mix, including things like what you characterize as the green energy, solar power, wind power. In
none
fact,
of which
in this
has, nothing in that era, in that area, has succeeded without huge government subsidies.
And no new thing has ever succeeded without huge government subsidies, such as railroads. I mean, come on. This is not a new thing.
I want to get back to one theme.
Coal was subsidized.
I want to get back to one thing, since we have a variety of thoughts and opinions on this around the table this evening. Is there something in our history that America is, that we're unique, and we're unique to seize these issues now? He talked about declaring that Americans are made for this moment. What is it about this moment, if you believe the president or you disagree with the president, what is unique about this moment, or was that pure rhetoric? Does it really mean anything at all? I want to get everybody an opportunity. We've got to go to a break. I want to give everybody an opportunity to think about that. Are we uniquely at a special moment in history, or are we only there because we have a president who may want to take us down a different road, part of a changing America and part of delivering on the promise of change that he made, 2008. Back shortly from Chicago, 1-800-723-8289. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us wherever you're listening, from coast to coast and border to border. It's nice to have you with us every Sunday night on America's great radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. Dave Lundy is here this evening. Dave Lundy is our Democrat. I was going to say progressive, but he's more of a moderate, as he said. And let me just elaborate. You're the president of Aileron Communications.
Yes.
And you said you were a little surprised by the speech. You were a little uncomfortable the first time you heard it?
I was. And I haven't heard a Democratic president or any president articulate the progressive vision so clearly, because we've been, progressives have been hiding for, trying to couch their rhetoric, much like conservatives have done on a whole host of issues. But, progressives have certainly done on the core issues. And it was just it was something that it was a little jarring for me. And after hearing it the second time, I thought it was great.
Bruno Barrett also joins us. He is the executive director of For All Illinois.
For the Good of Illinois.
It's Good of Illinois.
501c4.
And you are wearing, for those who are watching this on television, you are wearing people that are listening on radio, you're wearing a beautiful yellow scarf, and it says, it's National School Choice Week.
That's right.
Which we will discuss in the second hour. But What is National School Choice Week, and what are we supposed to do?
National School Choice Week is basically a celebration of every single type of school choice, whether it's charters, vouchers, digital learning, everything under the sun that basically creates a vast new array of education services instead of the expensive and.
So how do you celebrate? Do you bring an apple to school? What do you do?
Well, we started off with a huge kickoff in Phoenix, Arizona. 8,000 people, all from charter schools from across Arizona. There's a train. It's pulling through Chicago on the evening of the 29th. There's going to be a big celebration. People are welcome to go to it. You can look at the National School. It's schoolchoice.org or schoolchoiceweek.org, and you can find out where to get to the celebration at Union Station here. There's a whistle-stop tour going all the way across the country.
Good.
And we're just celebrating the idea that we need choices in education, and we're starting to get them.
And we're going to talk about that in hour number two, because it is one of the issues that the president ticked off on a variety of things that need to be addressed, and he thinks this is the time to do it, and so we're going to do our part in the second hour. We've got differing opinions on it. John McCarron also joins us. For 30-plus years, he was with the Chicago Tribune as a columnist, as a reporter, and as a member of their editorial board. He is now an adjunct professor at DePaul University. Marty Garrity also joins us. He is a former retired real estate executive, still doing some real estate work, and he's our conservative commentator and has been with us for many, many years.
And, Bruce, I just want to say that I've had a number of people ask me, is Bruce Dumont okay? He's looking sort of wan, sort of he's lost
Svelte.
Weight.
I
want to just say, Bruce, I know that you're fine. I know that you've been on an extremely rigorous regime to lose weight, and you look terrific, and you I'm guessing that you feel a lot better.
I do.
But for those people out there in TV land who are saying, "Gee, is Bruce okay?" He is way better than okay. He has done amazing things, and it's a tribute to your determination to improve your health.
Well, thank you very much for your kind words. For those listening on radio, I've lost 45 pounds since October 15th.
Excellent.
And so thank you for your kind words. We'll go out and we'll have a steak to celebrate that.
With fries?
No, au gratin potatoes. Let's go to Carson's.
Yeah, with some garlic bread on the side. No, I gave all that stuff up. And again, thank you for your kind words. And for those that are worried about my health, I'm doing fine. Thank you very much. And I'm going to continue to keep going. By the way, for those listening in the Chicagoland area within the sound of my voice, let me remind you that started last Friday, but Tuesday through Saturday, we're presenting for the next several weeks, we're presenting a tribute, a 30th anniversary retrospective on Harold Washington on the air. He's the first black mayor of the city of Chicago. For those listening around the country, admission to the museum is free during that period. Again, it started last Friday. It will run through February 28th, Tuesday through Saturday, from 10 in the morning to 5 p.m. So if you've always wanted to come down and see the museum, we're at 360 North State Street. And appreciation goes out to Allstate, Chicago's Good Hands people, for making that free admission to the museum possible. So come on down. It's free of charge until the 28th of February. And again, if you grew up in the city of Chicago, or even if you're listening around the country, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and that is that there would not have been a President Barack Obama had there not been a Mayor Harold Washington in Chicago. It was an inspirational time 30 years ago. John McCarron, you covered it. A lot of people around the table were involved either on either side of that discussion. But again, the charismatic magnetism of Harold Washington seen on radio and television. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Wilmington, North Carolina, where Jack is listening to us on WAAV. Nice to hear from North Carolina. Go ahead.
Bruce, first I'd like to say I enjoy your show. I'm calling because I was listening to your program, and I wanted to help the conservatives or the Republicans sitting around your table there. You had one of your guests state the fact that we're paying the lowest rate of taxes in a long time. And nobody piped up and said, we got a very high unemployment rate. What is it, 10, 12, 13%, the real unemployment rate? If those people were working and paying taxes, I doubt the rate we're paying would be so low. I read an article that the worker participation rate was the lowest it's been since the 50s. And then another comment was made that the natural gas, the coal-fired plants, were being replaced by natural gas, and that's true here in North Carolina. A half a dozen of them were shut down, but I read an article that they're being dismantled by peace and sent to Uruguay and Paraguay in South America. So if they're helping, the global warming, I thought it was global warming, not just the United States warming.
All right, let's let everybody respond to your points, and I'm going to kind of broaden your point by saying, I guess if there was one thing that was very conspicuous by its absence in the inaugural address, and I'm sure it will be addressed, hopefully it will be addressed in the State of the Union, and that is the jobless recovery. I mean, the economic situation. I mean, if you're out of work, I mean, it was a good speech to listen to, but I don't know if it gave you much to dream about.
Well, let me just respond on a couple things. You are correct, caller, that one of the reasons that we're paying the lowest share of federal taxes since 1950 is partially because of the poor economy. But in fact, the percentages have been dropping on a fairly steady basis. There was a story as recently as today's New York Times talking about comparing the taxation of various income groups since 1980, clearly showing that since 1980, the taxes on the highest income groups have dropped the most at a fairly meaningful level from, I believe, average 49% overall taxation to less than 42%. And by the way, just to be perfectly clear, I am not saying I want to pay more taxes, and I expect to be paying more taxes. Mm-hmm. I don't like taxes. I'm human. I like to spend the money myself. But if we want a certain kind of government, we have to pay for it. And I think the conservatives would agree with that. And the question is, well, then what kind of government do we want and who gets thrown over the side?
Marty, what even kind of government do you
even
want?
Even if the rates are higher or lower for the very rich these days, the amount of taxes paid by the very rich as compared with the middle classes and with the poor has gone way up. And so a much larger percentage of our national income, of our taxable income, is paid by the very rich than by the middle class or the poor.
I want to, more so than in the 50s. I want to ask Marty and Bruno, of the many things that government does, what are the things that they shouldn't be doing anymore, in your view? Bruno.
Well, clearly.
Specific.
First of all, we should stop subsidizing corn. We should stop subsidizing windmills. We should stop subsidizing Solyndra and other companies, which other people say are going to fail. Whether you're in the business or not, the fact of the matter is that when you're in this position, you just stop subsidizing those kinds of things. Next,
Does that include gas and oil?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It includes gas and oil. I mean, let us all be fair.
I want the right side of our table to come up with a list of things you want to get rid of.
Okay, and the other thing, at the end of the day, the big enchilada is Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And those things have to be tackled. And while it's possible—
Be specific. What do you want done?
I think Paul Ryan's plan was a very good start. Okay, it can be tweaked. It can be improved. There's other things you can do with it. The idea that we
raising the age of retirement, and then
if you have to voucherize some of this stuff and have some kind of competition in there, the
open ended
yes, the open ended aspect of the current Medicare and Medicaid is unsustainable. And in the president's own speech, when he talks about tackling the tough issues and we're going to have to do this about Medicare and Medicaid, that's code word for people who talk about dog whistles. There's only one word that means, and that's rationing, and that's going to come.
Add to the list of things that government does that you don't think they should do.
Government owns public education. Clearly, as a nation, we have an interest in seeing children educated at elementary and secondary levels.
Second hour is going to be all on that subject.
I understand that, but that's one of those things that government we should be subsidizing it, but we should not be owning it. We should not be controlling it and making it something that if you live here, you must go there because the district says.
What do we get out of?
I'd rather talk about the things that that government should be doing, and it should be protecting us. It should be keeping another 9/11
from happening. So the list of things that government does that they shouldn't do is relatively small.
If you fix Social Security, this is what's so hilarious. With all of this Sturm und Drang about how we all hate each other, if you fix Social Security and you fix Medicare, we're done. When we come back,
I want to let the left side of the table react to all these suggestions that the right side of the table have proposed. Maybe you want to weigh in on that. 1-800-723-8229 from coast to coast and border to border live every Sunday night. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. And now, those who are left of center on our panel this evening or closer to Democrats, you are going to react to some of the suggested cuts that our conservatives made in the previous segment.
Well,
John McCarron.
I was going to pick up on Bruno's warning us that rationing is coming by saying, I hope so. You know, I'll even take Sarah Palin's death panels. I think that's a great idea. I think what he's referring
How
to
will that work?
What he's referring to is the medical efficacy panels, or as the Republicans call them, the nameless bureaucrats who happen to be doctors and PhDs and understand are informed by tests about what works and
non-transparent
and what doesn't. There we go. Not transparent.
Unlike your insurance companies, which are remarkably transparent.
Bruce, I mean, we're approaching 20% now in the share of gross domestic product that we're spending on healthcare. There are no breaks on this system. The only thing I see in Obamacare that could do this, and I'm hoping that's what the president was referring to in his inaugural speech, is efficacy panels, experts saying, we're not going to spend money on this, we will spend money on that. Now, the Republicans want to do that by giving everyone a voucher and saying, go buy whatever you want. My problem with that is for poor folks and even for much of the middle class, the voucher just isn't going to get you to affordable family insurance.
But is there anything that the conservatives have said tonight that you could agree, or do you not agree, that government can be significantly cut or reduced in size and cost? David.
Look, we have seen this coming for a generation. We have been talking about the aging American population, how health care costs were going to be exploding, how that was going to trigger an enormous run-up in the deficit, an enormous run-up in the national debt. This is not news. It's not like we suddenly woke up and here we are with this problem. What we have done, though, is we have failed to deal with any meaningful reforms, whether those reforms are the kinds that Barack Obama did as part of Obamacare, where they cut $717 billion, which did not affect benefits. It just affected the bureaucracy and the insurance companies. Or are we going to do it the way Republicans are proposing and the way Paul Ryan proposed, which is to say, we're going to give you a voucher for your insurance. We're going to throw out the federal health insurance. I have to say this, Bruce. I deal with this issue on behalf of my father and my mother-in-law on a daily basis, both of whom have a serious disability, both of whom are dealing with Medicare. Medicare works really well. What doesn't work well is that we haven't been able to confront these choices because the demagoguery that takes place. I mean, they
at least admit the demagoguery is on both sides. I mean, you guys demonize any and all kinds of change.
And Republicans took over the House in 2010 largely on the basis of $717 billion in Medicare cuts that didn't actually cut benefits.
But you're also,
reducing payments to providers. It wasn't insurance companies. It was providers who got cut.
Insurance companies.
But our left of center guests have not talked about the Defense Department.
I'll take a
shot at that. When I look at the way warfare is changing into sort of this asymmetrical
drones guerrilla, unlimited.
Yeah, I mean it's there are no more armies arrayed in the field or fleets on the ocean. I mean there's a potential for that to reoccur, but it just seems like we have. We're building this a new joint strike fighter, and we're about to redo all our nuclear submarines, our boomers, our ICBM launchers. Who's the enemy there? Where's the threat? It just seems like we're spending money just out of inertia on these high-tech systems that cost billions and billions of dollars. I don't see it.
Could the threat be a nuclear Iran?
Yes.
Or a nuclear North Korea.
And we know that North Korea wants to try their things out.
Absolutely. Look, let's face certain facts. We are not going to be fighting a land war in Europe. Therefore, we do not need 2.1 million men and women under arms in protecting us from the hordes in East Germany and Czechoslovakia, two places that no longer exist. We are fighting these weird asymmetrical situations. Frankly, I think Hillary Clinton warned in her testimony this week, this is becoming a much more dangerous world. We all have to be vigilant about that. But the question isn't, are we vigilant? The question is, do we need to spend the dollars do we need to spend more than the next 15 militaries in the world, including China?
Human
or are there better ways to go about fighting these war? Human intelligence, drones, and other kinds of warfare that are different and may not be as expensive.
We have a very short period of time, but you mentioned Hillary Clinton. Before we go off in this first segment, for those that saw Hillary Clinton testify before Congress, either watched every word of it or saw the television clips, did she help or hurt her cause for her political future?
I would say she hurt her cause. I still to this day do not understand why and how an administration gets away with basically lying to the American people bald face for a full week. And when Hillary Clinton did her little outburst, that outburst was planned. The words that she used were scripted because she was deflecting the answer to the one question this administration can't give, which is, why did you lie to the American people for a week when you knew it had nothing to do with a mob and a riot?
I felt the same way, that the indignation was a little contrived. But go ahead,
Dave. I agree with that, but Once again, you're obsessing about talking points when the question is, what caused this? How can we prevent it? And what do we do in the future? I mean,
she says it doesn't matter what caused it.
No, that's not what she said. What she said is that it doesn't matter what led to the talking points that were, you're right, 5 days. It was 5 days. In the meantime, here we are 4 months later. There are questions that need to be answered with how do you keep people safe?
One of the questions is that, do you want, as a future commander-in-chief, someone who didn't read the tea leaves, didn't read the cables, wasn't able to act quickly in one situation, does that send a signal that maybe that person, if they were the leader of the free world and the president of the United States, maybe they would make the same mistake? Hillary certainly doesn't want that question to be raised, but we just raised it. In the next hour, if you're listening to us on radio, we're going to be talking about school choice and public education and whether or not it should be funded in America. 1-800-723-8029 if you want to jump in on that discussion. If you're watching us on television, see you next week. Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway this week. Tonight featuring commentary by Bruno Barron, Marty Garrity, Dave Lundy, and John McCarron. Our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8029. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. And again, in this hour of our show, and we're going to try something a little bit different as the format of this program evolves. We're in our 33rd year. We will celebrate our 33rd anniversary coming up in June. And you may recall, if you're a longtime listener to the show, we used to have three guests on the show. And as campaign 2012 unfolded, we found out that it would probably be a better idea to have a balanced discussion between those that are right of center and those left of center. And so we expanded the base from three guests to four guests, got good response from those out in radio and TV land that listen and watch this program each and every week. And something else that we want to try in this year, and it sort of picks up on what the president had to say, is we have the luxury of having 2 hours every Sunday night. There are talk show hosts that are on each and every week, and they may bring a particular political bent to their discussions. We have the luxury of 2 hours every Sunday night, and the first hour of that show, as we plan it, is usually sort of contemporary, what happened that day, that week, as we did discuss the president's inaugural speech and Hillary Clinton's appearance on the Hill. But in the second hour, periodically, and tonight is one of those nights, we're going to spend the second hour kind of delving into an issue where we can maybe get a little more differing opinions and maybe some solutions to issues. And we're going to touch base tonight with something, a subject that doesn't really get as much exposure nationally as it should, and that is education. Public education, charter schools. I mean, if you're listening to this program, you're a graduate of some form of education, and your children or your grandchildren are engaged in education on a daily basis. And Bruno Barron, he is the senior fellow of the Heartland Institute. That's a libertarian think tank in Chicago. And he is the senior fellow for education. And so in the first hour, you mentioned that this coming week is School Choice Week.
Correct.
So set the table, if you will, no pun intended, mm-hmm. set the table for the discussion that you would like to have us have in the next hour of this broadcast with the audience certainly invited to join in.
Sure, Bruce, and thank you very much for the opportunity to do this. It's the issue that really drives me on a lot of the political issues that I talk about. National School Choice Week, really quickly, is the brainchild of some folks at the been working in the school choice movement for a long time, and they basically said, you know, we need something to popularize this and to make people know why this is here and what's going on, and they decided one way to do that from a marketing perspective is to do what a lot of other organizations and a lot of other movements have done, and you put a week or a day or a month behind it, and then you just start marketing that. The first year was, this is the third year of it, the first year they had 150 events nationwide. Second year, they had 450 events nationwide. This year, 3,600 events across the country at schools, charter schools. This is the first year we've even gotten some school districts and district schools helping in this, which is a real shock.
In the first hour, when I asked our two conservative guests this evening what they would do to cut federal spending, Marty, you talked a little bit about education, but you did not say, as a lot of conservatives do say, get rid of the federal Department of Education. Is there a reason to have a federal Department of Education? If so, what would that reason be? And by having a federal secretary level in the cabinet, does that give that person a bully pulpit to improve the quality of education?
I haven't thought much about the federal education department. I can't imagine having a big problem if it were wiped out, but it's not one of those things that I go to bed at night and I
kneel
down and pray for it.
Where do you start improving
education? I say you start by saying people should be allowed to send their kids where they want their kids to go to school. If you're a Muslim imam and you want to send your kid to a Muslim school, if it's your kid, you should be able to get whatever funding or whatever support people who go to public schools get. You should be able to get that for your
kid.
Let's
hear from the progressive side of the table. Dave, is that a good idea?
You know, look, it sounds great in theory, but the devil's in the details and the implementation and where do the funds go. I will tell you, I deal with this on a personal basis. I have a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old. My 7-year-old, we lived in the city for 28 years. We just moved about 5 months ago to the suburbs for precisely the school reason. Now, part of that was because my eldest has a peanut allergy, and frankly, the Chicago Public Schools, while they're making progress, aren't the safest in the world. But partially, our neighborhood school was no good. We were sending our kid to a private school, paying almost $20,000 a year for a school in Old Town called the Catherine Cook School. Candidly, it was somewhat of a mediocre educational experience, and we got very frustrated, and we said, you know what, this is crazy. Why are we killing ourselves? And we're about to have a second kid come along, and well, we have a second kid. He's about to go into the schools as well. We're going to pay $40,000 a year to give our kid a mediocre education when we can just move to the burbs and pay a little more in taxes and do better. That's great. We have the financial wherewithal to do that. That's our choice to do that.
And that's a common story.
And that's a very common story. And I had vowed for 30 years never to do this, by the way, because I grew up in the burbs, never wanted to go back. Nonetheless, you do things for your kids. But the problem is, all of these ideas about, well, you should be given the chance to go wherever you want to go. Okay, that's fine. Well, what do you do in lower performing schools? Does that mean you basically wind up doing away with lower performing schools and suddenly you have these mega schools?
Absolutely.
Okay, but hang on a second, because you will have mega schools. You're going to wind up having schools for, well, where are the kids going
to
go?
I want to get John.
There's answers.
I want to get John McCarron into this discussion. John.
Well, my Republican friends are strong on the Constitution and the forefathers, and you know Madison and Jefferson were very strong on that. Begged for a public, strong public education system. They looked down on societies. They looked back at societies where education was strictly a private matter, strictly what you could afford. And they said, no, this is a country that's going to have a educated citizenry, and to get there, we need a strong public school system. And frankly, if you take $5,000, $7,000, whatever the voucher is, out of the public school system, in my view, you know, less is less. That's just less money for the public school system.
But again, if an individual parent, as I understand what Marty suggested, if an individual parent had that ability to put their money and their children where they wanted their
money?
Children to
absolutely
be,
absolutely.
Well,
they
the money,
have
no, it,
their
it would
money.
Be, no, it would be. It would be money from
tax
the government.
Money. I pay they could District 65
they could put
in
it,
Evanston.
They could put it wherever they want, and the concept of putting it there would create an element of competition, and you would think that schools would be competing against each other, and thus the quality of education may go up.
I've never bought into the idea that the public school system would be better because it needed to compete with private schools. Wait, or
have you looked at
schools.
The city of Chicago?
So what's fascinating about John, and first of all, what his point is, and this is the same stuff that we hear in anti-education reform and anti-choice, is they all like to quote Jefferson. Jefferson was very much in favor of a highly, highly decentralized, he's literally on record as saying you'd have to be an idiot to put the federal government in charge of education, which is what's starting to happen. A lot of the other stuff John said, I can get to it in a short period of time or a long period of time, but it's basically provably wrong.
We will get to it in the next segment, 1-800-723-8029. Do you have suggestions on how to improve education in America? If you do, let's hear from you. From Palm Springs, California to Elkton, Pennsylvania, Elkton, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, 1-800-723-8029. Before we hear more from our guests around the table, let's head to Sharon in Elmhurst, Illinois. She's listening to us on 890 WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air, Sharon.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I have a comment, and I find the liberal guest on there very, very humorous because he swears he would never come back to the suburbs in 30 years, and suddenly he has children and an epiphany. Comes over him. Conservatives in the suburbs and beyond have always wanted the voucher system, the free choice, including many minorities, where the president pulled the rug out from under them in outside of Washington, D.C., to educate their kids where they want. And the number one question I have for the thugs here in Chicago is, where is the money? What are we doing with the money? He says the devil is in the details. Well, our question, sir, has always been, where is the money? I have a dear cousin who has been a teacher for over 30 years. She hates her job. Where is her part of her pension that she paid into? Where is the part on the politicians, the city of Chicago, to pay in for what she has coming to her? And unfortunately, she's just going to be retiring within the next 5 years. But I'll tell you something, to go out of a wonderful career, which used to be a real noble profession, hating it, that's truly a sad state of affairs. And I blame the Democratic Party in the state. We've had 40 years of Michael Madigan. We've had 40 years of liberal rule here, on and off, or moderate, if not milquetoast Republicans. Everybody wants to be able to provide the best education for their children. And yes, voucher system will do it. You get what you pay for. It's like we're not supposed to subsidize on your previous comment about green energy, and yet we're subsidizing nearly $10,000. People who make above, I think, who afford that electric car, they make $175,000 a year.
Sharon,
we find ourselves subsidizing them? I'm angry at the left.
Sharon, stay on the line, because I want to ask, and I'm going to start Bruno with this question. Where in the country where the voucher system is operating to some extent, to some degree, where is it very successful? And what problems, if any, have they had in implementing that system?
Well, first of all, the place where it's been the longest has been in Milwaukee. Second, they've had a program in Ohio, which precipitated the Supreme Court suit, and then it's now in place in certain aspects in special education in Florida, and now it's just been placed in Indiana.
Is education in Milwaukee? I mean, it's been there for a long time. Are there
two things happen?
Surveys.
Yes.
I mean, do we know that it actually works there?
Yes, we do know that it absolutely works. We also know that there's plenty of everybody goes out and does studies, and of course the right wing studies make it look wonderful, and the left-wing studies make it look like it didn't work. And at the end of the day, when you parse it all out, the fact is that you see greater parental satisfaction, you see greater high school graduation rates, and most of all, and this goes to John's point about competition and him not trusting competition, is that all of the Milwaukee public schools that were under threat of losing students to vouchers actually saw noticeable dramatic improvement simply from having the voucher program in place.
Marty, I want to go back to something you said. You want to give the power to parents.
Yes.
To send their children to wherever they want to go.
Right.
And the money would come from the taxpayers, and they would take that check. Now,
yes.
You know, and I know, and everybody listening to this broadcast knows, not everyone who has a child is responsible. A lot of people who have children are totally irresponsible. They abuse their children. They're not smart enough. Again, forgive me for saying this on the air, but there's a lot of really stupid people out there. Yeah. All right, and you're saying that those folks, you're going to entrust in them the ability for them to make an intelligent decision about where their son or daughter goes to school.
Right. And I'll tell you, and the analogy that I would make is food stamps, or now it's called SNAP. those same people that you're disparaging for their intelligence are also charged with taking money from the government or get money from the government to feed their children, whether it's potato chips or potatoes au gratin or healthy food or whatever. Whatever it is, we pay them, we give them money to get food for those children that you're worried about.
Do you believe, and again, this is just pure gut here, do you think that the food that they're providing is healthy, quality food, or do you think it's junk food?
It's both, and it depends on the parents. They certainly don't want to see their kids die.
Of course it depends on the parents. Right. My point is, are you confident that a large portion of parents, if they had this bundle of cash for their child, do you think they would have the intelligence and the ability to do the research so that their children would be getting a good quality education? Would they have the skills to make the decision to send kids to the right school?
Those are the same arguments that you could make about food stamps, and also
about
Section 8 housing, about government supported housing, and what have we discovered in Chicago that is good housing and what's not? Bad housing is these institutional buildings where you put 500 people in, and
building that, well, we're not doing anymore because at least something can get repealed and but if you hand somebody a housing voucher and say, here, go find yourself a good apartment, it's a lot more intelligent than saying, here, go into Cabrini Green or the Robert Taylor homes and get killed or murdered or get into the drug trade.
If you want any place to live, must live in Cabrini
Green. I'll just very quickly say this, because I know that Dave wants to jump in here. I trust the people more than I trust a gigantic bureaucracy that is much more interested in its own self-propagation and spending. The worst crack mom who doesn't know anything has a higher moral right to make a decision on that than the bureaucracy does. And what happens is that when all people have more choices, this is exactly what happened in Milwaukee. The rising tide does lift all boats. The mom may not be that concerned, but the schools will get better regardless.
Dave, do you agree with that?
Well, I just want to address a couple of things first that the caller called me out on. Number one, a voucher would not have allowed me to move to Wilmette and send my children to Wilmette Public Schools. Number two, the subsidies that are taking place right now in terms of Chicago and the suburban school districts are exactly the opposite of what the caller would suggest. Right now, the city of Chicago is subsidizing, and residents of the city of Chicago are subsidizing suburban pensions, suburban school pensions, because of a cockamamie thing that was put into law many years ago. This is called commonly referred to as the cost shift. So as a new resident of the suburb, again, not that I like paying more taxes, but I think it's grossly unfair that people on the south side are subsidizing nutrier a school districts.
That's really not true, because the city of Chicago gets huge amounts per kid from the state. Evanston, Nutrier.
I'm talking about the pensions.
Gentlemen, we're talking to a national audience. Let's broaden it. John?
Well, Bruce, you bring up an interesting point. A lot of parents are disengaged, maybe even sociopathic. Maybe they're, as you say, as Bruno said, crack moms. Those are the ones that aren't going to volunteer their kids to go to a charter school, or much less take a voucher and go to a private school. And one reason Bruno is right, they do have higher graduation rates voucher uses. And one reason is there's a certain amount of cherry picking or self-selection that's going on, where the more capable families and the more capable students are opting into the voucher programs. And okay, I mean, let's just be that as it may, but what do we do then with the residue of kids with behavioral problems, with uninvolved parents, with chaotic homes? What happens to them, especially because the money is going to the out the door with vouchers?
No, but here's my question. If you have an irresponsible parent, okay, and I'll let everybody define what an irresponsible parent is, okay? All right, they have money. That money can only be used to educate their children, whether they have one, two, three, or four children. They've all got to go. The decision has to be made. Okay, let's say that they, they can't make a decision. The child goes to public school. All the money for those children, they go to that public school. Now, if other parents are more educated, more involved, more in tune with what their options are, they're taking children out of school A and they're bringing it to school B. Thus, the student-teacher ratio in the public school, where the irresponsible, where the parents of the irresponsible parents are going, could that child end up with a better education?
No, I don't think so, because they took the money with them, so the student-teacher ratio would get worse.
No, they're not taking the money of the students that are going to that school.
See, this is, and it's an excellent illustration, and I think you put it very well, Bruce. The interesting thing here is that, and this is what drives me crazy. Why, and this is to any soccer mom out there who's suspicious about voucher, and it's any union drone out there who thinks that this is the issue, why on God's green earth does any one of us care how much money flows into the bottomless maw of a bureaucratic school district? It's not about the money going to the school district. It's not about the superintendent's pension or the superintendent's car allowance.
All these discussions are about pensions.
That doesn't educate a child. What educates a child is to say, here's $5,000, here's $4,000, here's $3,000, here's $7,000. Doesn't matter. If you have control of that money, you take that money. So John's whole thing about they take the money with them is completely false, because all of you listening out there, you have got to stop caring about this absurd entity called a school district, and you've got to start thinking, wait a minute, instead of $10,000 going into this giant school district and maybe a third of that going into the classroom and the rest of it going into roofing contracts and busing contracts and pensions, maybe all of that $7,000 goes into actually choosing the kind of education you want for your kid. And I'm going to really quickly end with this, and it's all about resource allocation and efficiency. We all know that one size fits all doesn't work. We all know we can't have one car company and one food company. So the whole point of this is that what we need is money following the child to a vast new array of specifically tailored outcomes.
The next
question
when we come back, I know Dave's chomping at the bit to comment. The other point is what happens, you know, in this, if this new devised system that you're coming up with, where do the teachers go? Where does a young idealistic teacher go? Do they want to go to the lesser school and they want to build it up? Or do they want to go to school where they're paid money so they can pay their student loan back? Back shortly. From Hollywood, California to Hollywood, Florida, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Dave Lundy is here. He is our card-carrying Democrat. He is the president of Aileron Communications. John McCarron is also our other left of center guest. For many years, he was a reporter and a columnist and an editorial board member for the Chicago Tribune. He now is an adjunct professor of journalism at DePaul University. Also joining us this evening is Marty Garrity. He is a retired commercial real estate executive once upon a time, an elected official as alderman in the town of Evanston, Illinois, just to the north, which is the home to Northwestern University for those people listening around the country. And Bruno Barrett also joins us. He is a senior fellow at the Heartland Institute. His area of expertise is public education or education, and he is here to talk about National School Choice Week. It starts tomorrow, and there's a caravan that's going all over the country. He'll give you a little more information and give you a website in case you want to know where this caravan is going to be in your particular state. He will give that to you before you go off the air, or before we go off the air. So if you want to get a pencil and paper, you'll be ready when he gives it. But you gave some interesting statistics during the break about the difference between administrators and teachers in the public education system in the country. Bruno?
One fact that very few people know when they debate this issue is, or discuss this issue, is that nationally, out of all the people, all the public employees in public education, there are, you know, figures change here and there, but these figures are from 2010, 6.3 million people employed in public education. 3.2 million of them are teachers. The rest are administration and support. Now, the interesting thing is that anybody can turn around and say, well, we need those people because we have to do this and we have to do that and we have to meet with these mandates. And they will give you good reasons on paper why we need all of that administration with all of the, you know, we have these many districts and we have all of this. And on paper, those are going to sound like good reasons. The fact of the matter is it's a perfect example of why the United States of America, another true fact, spends over somewhere between $10,000 to $11,000 per child in this country on education in aggregate. And doesn't show up as well as it should anywhere on national or international tests, and more than the international test, it just does horribly with dropout rates in the inner city, and it's a travesty. It's a crime.
Let's switch gears for a moment, and let's talk about charter schools. Where are charter schools most successful? And for those people who may not have children in the schools or have not had them in schools for a long time, what exactly is a charter school? What separates it from a public school? Marty Garrity? Nope. Or Bruno?
A charter school is a public school that is allowed freedom, so to speak, from the district or the state bureaucracy. It has more autonomy. It has less rules and regulations. As a matter of fact, the Heartland
Better
Institute...
Better education?
It is better education. There is debate on that. And, again, it has higher graduation rates. Some have a higher – there's a very, very highly debated study called the Credo Study, which says 17% of charter schools are better than the local district schools, 30-some-odd percent are the same, and the remainder actually do more poorly based on test scores. But there's all kinds of reasons for that, which is actually the opposite of cherry-picking.
In a political world that we live in, Marty, isn't the charter school – isn't that half a loaf? Isn't that a much more reasonable something to aspire for than a complete voucher system, which seems to be politically, it seems to be the cards are stacked against?
Absolutely, Bruce. I agree that if I can't have vouchers, I'll take a charter school, because the charter schools have one added advantage of being able to be destroyed or being able to be wiped out. If they're in that bad group, they can be taken out, they can be changed, the contract can be dropped. Public schools, you can't get rid of public schools, both here in Chicago and around the country. If a public school is bad, it's going to stay bad. But fundamentally, that's...
Our school's bad. Dave.
You got to let me in here, Bruce. I've been sitting here quietly listening for about 20 minutes now, which is not my nature anyway. This fantasy that we can just have a choice and send our kids to only the best schools and the bad schools, well, you know what? Those poor kids, their parents are too stupid, and so they're in there. That's absurd. The whole problem of public education is that you're dealing with an enormous set of varied students, some who have behavioral problems, some who come from problem homes, some who come from lower socioeconomic bases. You have to deal in a public school with the breadth. Charter schools is the latest experiment. I'm in favor of experimentation. I would experiment the hell out of anything to come up with a better way. But the fact is, there have been plenty of examples where public schools have been turned around. The one that I'm most familiar with is in Lakeview. It's called Nettlehorst. I don't send my kids there, but I know a lot of parents who do. Nettlehorst was a hellhole of a school. It was a terrible school.
But you know what turned
parental
around?
Parental involvement.
That's right.
Parental involvement.
Money. But here's the point. When you have a public school, and I think it's one of the reasons why you move to the suburbs. The point is, if you're in a public school, your children are going to be there with children who are coming from homes where the parents don't care too much. They're not engaged. And what I'm saying is, as that population within that school grows, your children who are nurtured at home by parents that care, you're going to be in the minority. Their education is going to be diluted because they're surrounded by children who go home to families where the parents don't care. And isn't that what we have when we talk about, you know, education crumbling in certainly the inner cities and in urban areas? Isn't that what we're really talking about? There are too many children from families who are children of parents who don't care, and they're all thrown into school, and they bring the standards down. They make school different. They make it hard. They act up in class. There's no discipline. They go home. Their parents don't do anything to help them. Isn't that what we're talking about?
I think you make a good point. I think there's liberals have two problems when it comes to discussing education. One is they are hesitant to criticize teachers' unions, and two, they're hesitant to criticize fellow parents, especially the ones you just described.
But they should.
They should, absolutely.
Because you know what? If we had a group of teachers here, if all of our guests tonight were teachers, you know the first thing they would say, because they hear shows like this where the teachers are the bad guys, you know what they would say is, the problem are parents.
Yeah.
The teachers are paranoid.
Teachers are paranoid because they're getting
beat up. But they see it every day.
They're getting beat up constantly, and their defenders, I guess the liberal progressives, are unable to voice what really, in many cases, is the problem, and that is the parents in the home.
Marty.
The people who say, well, there's cherry picking going on, it's a bad thing, are essentially saying to those good parents, if we can use good parents and bad parents, they're saying to those good parents, you have an obligation to leave your child in this bad school, because otherwise the bad school will have only bad students.
I'm not saying that at all.
What we're saying is you have an obligation to help.
Fundamentally, you are.
No, it's implicit. No, it's not implicit. I'm saying there are a lot of kids. You can't just focus on the ones where the parents say, we're going to move our kids to the suburb or to this better school. Look, when I was in the city of Chicago, we tried to get our kid into one of the better schools. Chicago has school choice. I applied to, 25 different schools with a separate application for each. It was an absolute nightmare, and at the end of the day, I didn't get into any decent schools.
But, Dave, why should you have to do that? Why shouldn't you just be able to take this check for $7,000, find the school that you want, or 12 or whatever it is, find the school that you want, no applications, no messing around with not getting accepted. It's a bell curve.
You do not have only schools on the upper end of the bell curve. My favorite moment in law school is when I was teaching. I was in third year, and I was telling a group of first years that right now 100% of the people sitting in this room think they're going to be in the top 10% of the class, and 90% of you are wrong. It's a bell curve. There will be better schools and better parents and worse parents.
Naperville, Illinois. You're on WLS. Go ahead. And coast to coast.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Very good.
I am a high school teacher, but I believe I have the silver bullet, and I'm living proof of that. The silver bullet is teacher ownership. I have a side job where I create curriculum, lesson plans, class materials. I do not allow the school to take ownership of that and share it with anyone else. I license it to different schools. I, as a better teacher, because I'm the one who actually went the extra step and made these materials, I make extra money by licensing this stuff. If someone else comes along and wants to make something better, the school can license that instead. So we're instilling private sector competition in these public schools without really changing anything. And through this process, as a public school teacher, I make $300,000 a year. Most of my money comes from the curriculum, and that's the way it should happen. So,
Doug, what do you teach?
It costs less.
I'm
a U.S. history teacher, and I designed a curriculum that focuses on reading comprehension, and many districts have been really receptive to that.
How do they know? So what you're saying is any school district or any teacher can buy the rights to your lesson plan.
Yeah, they can. I license it on a yearly basis, and I update it every year, and they can renew the license for a lesser price later on. But the idea
what is a license cost? Since you're anonymous, what does a license cost?
Okay, a license will cost about. It depends on the size of the school, but anywhere I'd say about $3,000 a year. And I'll tell you right now, many school districts, what they'll do, they'll just have they'll hire some teachers for over the summer, pay them each $1,000 to come up with something. They can spend up to $20,000 to create a very subpar curriculum, because it doesn't matter what they spit out, because they're still going to get paid for the job regardless.
Doug, do me a favor. Stay on the line. We're going to go to a break. Stay on the line. I want to continue this discussion after the break. I want everybody to respond to that. And also, when we're through, stay on the line. I want to get your number back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Doug, are you still there calling from Naperville? Doug, are you still there? I guess Doug is gone. Doug, are you there? Going, gone. He's not. He's gone. Doug,
I'm here.
You there?
I'm here.
Okay, we thought you were out counting your. We thought you're out counting your money. we're still flabbergasted that you're making $300,000 as a public school teacher because of your ingenuity. So
right. I'm not making it from the school district. I'm just make that clear. I mean, I'm making it. I'm not. That's not my salary. I make this as the side business.
Right. That's the side business. My question to you is, where do you come down on our discussion this evening? Are you pro vouchers? Are you pro charter schools? Where do you come down? You're teaching in a public school, correct?
I am.
Okay. And where do you come
down?
I'd
like to keep that anonymous for now, but I do teach at a public school, and I believe in competition. I believe that's what facilitates great teachers. I know a lot of people like Diane Ravitch. She likes to say that teachers are already doing such a great job. They're doing as good as they possibly can, so merit pay wouldn't matter. But I'll tell you right now, I work very, very hard as a teacher and as a curriculum designer. And I would not work as hard as I could, as hard as I do, if I did not have an incentive in it. And the idea that, I know we want to see teachers as these completely noble people, but let's be honest, we live in a capitalist society, and if we want great things, we need to have an incentive in it, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Doug, give me the answer to the question, and then I want everybody else to weigh in on it, because I posed this question before the last commercial, or the commercial break before this one. And that is, if we have the public schools, and left in the public schools are the children of parents who really don't care too much, or they haven't taken the time to take the money that might be available to them. Let's think theoretically that they've got this $7,000 to $12,000 they could put anywhere. They put it in a school. Some schools obviously are going to have more students. They may have more parents that care. Thus, they will have more money. If you're a teacher, what type of teacher is going to go to the public school when the competition for quality teachers is going to probably pull them to a school where they would make more money?
I would say that the teacher who is trying to make more money is going to go to the school district that pays them more. But here's what I want you to keep in mind, though. If there truly was this, if we truly had school choice and we truly had what I call teacher ownership, all schools would be all high tides will raise all boats. I strongly believe that. And I don't think there's necessarily a problem with teachers looking for greener pastures. That's just going to be another form of competition. And the example that was used earlier where they compared it to food stamps, where, you know, sometimes they use buy good stuff, sometimes they buy junk food. Mm-hmm. The way the system is right now, the only option is junk food.
Or moving to the wealthy suburbs with the high property tax base.
Marty, in your particular case, you have a daughter who was a teacher, and she taught in an inner city school. A charter school.
Right.
She could have gone someplace else. She went to a charter school in a rough neighborhood. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. She was in Teach for America, and they that's what they do. Teach for America goes to rough neighborhoods. And Bridget stayed in that school for 2 years and fought like the Dickens for those kids, and still goes back. And the kids that she had remember her as somebody that was special for them.
So you believe that the number of quality teachers, the pool would be good?
Oh, yeah. Well, we've got Teach for America is just a wonderful program that essentially goes out and finds the top graduates in places like Harvard and Yale and Illinois and Michigan, and 20,000 people apply for 3,000 jobs for this program, and these are terrific people, basically working pretty much, I think, in charter schools and in special places where they their talents can be appreciated, and they have no education background. They are not education majors. She majored in history and I'm forgetting what else
majored in. Anyone else have a last question for Doug?
I just want to say how much I appreciate him calling in, because he illustrates, even though it's only in a microcosm of one district and the work that he's doing, he illustrates how much better our education system would be if we allocated resources based on what the child and the parents want, instead of allocating resources on these completely unnecessary, fictitious entities called school districts, which we simply out and out need to get rid of.
Doug, we say farewell to you, and stay on the line. Our producer wants to get your name and number, because I do want to contact you for maybe a continued discussion of this particular matter. I want to come back to a political issue. Thanks very much for your call. I want to come back to a political issue because, again, during one of the breaks, you went on and on about school districts.
Right.
And also you said early in the program that one of the reasons why school choice doesn't get the political clout of a national campaign is that in many states, including in Illinois, there's a coziness between smaller school districts and Republican politics. So they're standing in the schoolhouse door for reform as well. Let's talk about the politics of school districts, because by breaking up school districts, you're asking people to give up political power. You got 20 seconds to answer.
Well, actually, I would say getting rid of school districts would give people much more political power, because then the money would start having to follow the child instead of the district. School districts are a ruse to literally centralize and federalize and education and get local property taxpayers to pay for it.
If people want to know more about the National School Choice Week and their efforts, where do they go?
First of all, go to Union Station on Tuesday night. There's going to be a big party on
listening around
choice.
The country. Where do they go?
They go to schoolchoiceweek.com, schoolchoiceweek.com, and they can set up their own event any day this week.
That was Bruno Barrett. He is from the Heartland Institute. Marty Garrity also joins us. Marty, thanks very much. From DePaul University, it has been John McCarron. And from Aileron Communications, it has been Dave Lundy. This program is a Genevieve production, produced in association with W. Willis Talk Radio in Chicago. Our thanks to Tom Burr-Cruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, Super Bowl Sunday, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.